First of all, I'd like to thank Rob and Ravi, David, Annabelle, Ellie, and Lucien for organizing this conference, and Perimeter Institute for hosting this conference. Today I'm gonna talk about why personally I think that the notion of contextuality introduced by Cochin and the speaker actually is important to understand what quantum theory is and why. But first of all, I need to start with my personal motivation for studying these things, which is not other than understanding where does quantum theory come from. In a way, my position can be summarized in this quote by June Wheeler: quantum theory does not trouble me at all. What eats me is to understand where does it come from. So keeping this in mind, first of all, I will explain what I mean by quantum contextuality and why I adopt this particular definition of quantum contextuality. And for that, I will start with 1926. In 1926, Max Born, in his famous paper, said, "We have so far no reason to believe that there are some inner properties of the atom which condition a definite outcome. Of we hope later to discover such properties? Or of we to believe that the agreement of theory and experiment is a pre-established harmony founded on the non-existence of such conditions?" This is the beginning of the discussion of hidden variables in quantum theory. Later you have von Neumann, EPR, and finally we end up into the Cochin-Speckle theorem, which addresses the following question: is it possible that at any instant of time the observed quantities, and by that I mean the same as Heisenberg and von Neumann, meaning those entities represented in quantum theory by projection value measures, each possess a definite value regardless of whether they have been measured? The answer of Cochin and Speckle is no, if the system is represented by a Hilbert space of dimension larger than 2. And yes, if the system is represented by a Hilbert space of dimension 2. The physics behind the Cochin-Speckle theorem is that you have basically to decide between these two options. One is called outcome indeterminism. The reason why this assignment is impossible, it is because the observables do not have predetermined values. The values are created when the measurements are performed. Or the other option is called outcome contextuality. The reason is because the observables have predetermined values, but they are contextual, meaning they depend on which other compatible observables are measured. But in the theorem, there is a basic assumption, which is outcome non-contextuality for sharp measurements. And this makes a difference with respect to Bell's theorem, in which the assumption of locality is kind of theory independent. While here, the problem is that the notion of sharp measurements they have were only defined within quantum theory. Namely, the term sharp measurement is actually a term introduced in the 60s to design observables represented in quantum theory by projecting value measures in contrast to POVMs. So the question is how to make a theory-independent definition of what a sharp measurement is. And the solution is this. It's an operational definition of sharp measurements for general probabilistic theories. Actually, the definition, this solution was provided independently by Matthias Kleinmann and Giulio Chirivella and John. So what I will do first is to establish clearly what I mean by a sharp measurement outside of quantum theory. Okay? First of all, let's start with the notion of measurement. The measurement is an interaction between a system and a device which produces an outcome. It is described by a collection of events. each of them labeled by an outcome. In the case of a demolition measurement, like this one, the events are called effects, and the measurement is described by a collection of effects. A general probabilistic theory assigns for every state a probability for every outcome. Okay? For every system, there is a particular effect U called unit, such that for all states and all measurements, this sum of probabilities, the probabilities of all the effects and measurements, equals the probability of this unit, and you can say it is 1. Okay? In quantum theory, U is represented by the identity operator on the Hilbert space, and this equation expresses the fact that quantum measurements are resolutions of the identity. The next ingredient is a refinement. We said that a measurement n is a refinement or fine graining of a measurement m if for all outcomes of n there is an outcome of m such that for all states the probability of the fine grain outcome is smaller or equal than the probability of the original one. This allows you to move to the notion of a non-demolition measurement. A non-demolition measurement or instrument is a measurement which transforms the state of the system into a new state. It is therefore described by a collection of transformations of the state for each outcome. Okay? Every demolition, non-demolition measurement is associated to a corresponding demolition measurement through this relation, which expresses this idea. You can implement a demolition measurement like this by making the non-demolition measurement and then measuring the unit. Okay? And with these ingredients, now we can formulate the definition of a sharp measurement in GPTs. A sharp measurement is a non-demolition measurement which cannot be detected when performed before any of its refinements. So, take a measurement, consider all possible refinements, all possible states, and you do the following thing. On one hand, you just, this is the refinement, you measure, you get the statistics. But if you identify an object like this, a non-demolition measurement such that cannot be detected in the sense that doesn't change the outcomes of this, no matter the state and no matter the refinement, this is a sharp measurement. Okay? This is the definition. And now the properties of a sharp measurement would actually explain why we call it a sharp as analogy with the sharp measurements in quantum theory. First of all, the first property is repeatability. A sharp measurement gives the same outcome when performed consecutively times. So you measure again. This is equivalent to just measures once. You always get the same outcome. The second property is minimal disturbance. A sharp measurement affects only the statistics of incompatible measurements. That is, if n is a compatible arbitrary measurement, then is not disturbed by the presence of the sharp measurement. Okay, then we need a notion of compatibility between sharp measurements. And two sharp measurements, capital M and capital N, are compatible if and only if, for any arbitrary measurement Q, the order in which you implement the measurement doesn't matter. It's what is explained in this thing. Okay? This allows us to define what we mean by a context, and it's nothing but a set of compatible sharp measurements. And out of that, you can define a mother measurement just by sequentially measuring each of the sharp measurements in any possible order. And hereafter, we will focus on experiments like this one, in which we have a sequence of sharp measurements, compatible sharp measurements. In these experiments, we will call an event a transformation between the initial state and the state after the last measurement. Now with this equipment, we can do something similar to the Bell inequalities, but for more general scenarios. And this is what we call a non-contextuality inequality. Charles Mertens allows us to define these inequalities for, let's say, arbitrary scenarios, here defined as sets of some measurements and their compatibility relation. And with them, we can detect things like single Q-treat contextuality or state-independent contextuality. Moreover, in analogy with the work of Fine and Supesan Sanotti, and also with Pitolsky, for a given contextuality scenario, there are inequalities, particular inequalities, non-contextuality inequalities, which provide necessary and sufficient conditions for the existence of a joint probability distribution. We will call them tight non-contextuality inequalities, and they will define what we call a non-contextual polytope. Let me add that there is no a unique way to do that. There is an alternative way to define a non-contextual polytope. You will hear about it this evening, which is the one proposed by Asin and colleagues. And Anna Belén will probably talk about it this evening. So here, I will define a quantum contextuality as anything that produces quantum correlations for compatible Sharpe measurements and is outside the non-contextual polytope for a given a scenario. The question is why? Well, I will try to argue why this particular notion, which seems to be at first sight very limited, actually teaches more about what is quantum theory and what we can infer about the role from the effectiveness of quantum theory than any other notion I know of non-classicality, including alternative versions, alternative definitions of contextuality. And for that, I will move to a little bit of history. I will call this a summary of 50 years of history of contextuality in 10 minutes. What I call the contextuality wars and what I teach from them. Okay, the first war is the fight between contextuality and non-locality. I mean, if you go to 1966, John Bell's paper in Reviews of Modern Physics, Bell himself gets something similar to the Kochan-Speckle theorem with the same assumption. But then he made the following observation. Different possibilities require different experimental arrangements. There is no a priori reason to believe that the result for a measurement in different contexts should be the same. And he finishes his paper saying, it would be very interesting replacing the arbitrary axioms objected to above by some condition of locality or separability of distance systems. This is the beginning of Bell's theorem. What is my reaction whenever I heard about this? Why I still attach to the notion of contextuality? Well, there are several reasons. Reason number one, to me, contextuality generalizes non-locality and provides a unifying paradigm for the sources of quantum information. Reason number two, contextuality requires less and has a broader scope. For instance, it doesn't presuppose the existence of parts or that causal influences propagate at fine speed. It neither privileges composite systems, nor entangled state, nor space-like separated measurements. Indeed, reason three is that there's a version of contextuality which put the emphasis on the measurements rather than on the states. But this is just the beginning. There are many reasons. Another one is that a device-independent approach cannot allow us to recover quantum correlations, not even for Bell inequality scenarios. And there's a simple argument for that, which is that real Hilbert space quantum series is enough to simulate any quantum correlation in a Bell inequality scenario. Let's move to the second war. The second war is contextuality versus the finite precision of measurement. And it started with a paper by David Mayer stating, first, only finite precision measurements are experimentally reasonable. And finite precision measurements cannot distinguish a dense subset from its closure. Okay? And then he saw that the rational vectors, which are dense in S2, can be colored in a Kochan-Spaker sense, so that the proof of the Kochan-Spaker theorem vanishes. This is the beginning of a long history with a lot of papers. On this side, we have Mayer defining this finite precision measurements, nullify the Kochan-Spaker, and this a lot of papers stimulated by that answering why they disagree and designing tools to explain why they disagree. I personally summarize the whole thing as follows. The contradiction with non-contextual hidden variable series can be proven in many different ways. In particular, can be proven even using the dense set proposed by Mayer. Contextuality is much more than the proof of the Kochan-Spaker theorem. Okay. In particular, you can prove contextuality with rational vectors in two lines, and this in this paper. But in addition to that, in the paper by Mayer, there was another reason to prefer Bell's theorem, which is that in contrast to the violation of Bell inequalities, no quantum over classical advantage for information processing can be derived from Kochan-Spaker theorem. Well, this is actually another reason why I am attached to contextuality. Reason number 5, contextuality allows us to identify new quantum over classical advantages. On one hand, because we can point out that simulating quantum contextuality with classical system requires classical system with higher memory. Second point, simulating contextuality with classical system with a finite number of states produces heat due to Landauer's principle. But mainly, you can see that, for instance, the violation of Mermin inequality by the Grimberger-Horn-Seilinger state, which is a form of contextuality, computes in the sense that upgrades the power of computation, of some computational models. Or that if a measurement-based quantum computer deterministically computes a non-linear Boolean function, then the resource must be fully contextual. Or the existence of an equivalence between contextuality and the possibility of universal quantum computation via magic state distillation. Okay. But also in this second contextuality world, there's the appearance of Bell inequalities again. I mean, as a solution of everything. This is by Clifton and Kent. Since violation of Bell inequalities can be verified without requiring that the observables can be measured with arbitrary high precision, Bell's theorem yields a method of falsifying local hidden variable theories. You don't have the same for non-contextual hidden variable theories. Well, and now let's move to the third contextuality word, which is contextuality versus unsharpness of measurements. It's made on these following observations by Rob. First observation, the outcome of a measurement depends deterministically on the ontic state of the system being measured, if and only if the measurement is sharp. Second, any realistic measurement necessarily has some non-vanishing amount of noise and therefore never achieves the ideal of sharpness. Now let me put an example. When Galileo Galilei was 26, he made some experiments in the Tower of Pisa, throwing bodies from the top and testing whether they reach the ground at the same time. And they didn't. Because any realistic measurement of the speed of falling bodies necessarily has some air resistance. However, Galileo was wise enough to neglect this effect. And that's the origin of gravitation. Namely, ignoring air resistance was a wise movement. And trying to make a similar argument here. And this argument starts with my reason number 6, which is that if you ask me what is the fundamental feature of quantum theory, I will answer the fundamental feature of quantum theory is that all measurements in quantum theory are sharp, in the sense that all can be conceived as sharp measurements in the larger systems. This is super curious. This comes from the words of Neumark, but precisely from the time when the works of Neumark were incorporated to the literature of quantum theory in the 60s. And a related reason, as you will see, reason number 7, is that the Kochs-Becker definition of quantum contextuality leads to a simple definition of quantum correlations, which, in trying to explain them, suggests a simple reason for why they are, and ultimately suggests what is quantum theory and explains why quantum theory is so effective. This is what I will try to argue now. And for that, I need to introduce what is called the exclusivity graph. Remember that in our framework, an event is state transformation occurring when compatible sharp measurements are performed on a state. That's an event. Two events are then equivalent if they correspond to indistinguishable transformations. And two events are exclusive if there is a sharp measurement that contains both of them. Out of this, we can define an exclusivity graph, a graph in which vertices represent events and edges exclusivity relations between them. Another problem is the following. What are the possible probability assignments in quantum theory to the vertices of a given exclusivity graph? No matter how, I mean, any quantum mean is allowed. We are not focusing in any particular scenario. I give you a graph, and I ask you this question. I allow you to construct any probability assignment within using quantum systems, okay? And this defines a set. And if you do a similar game with non-contextual models, you have another set. The first set, the quantum set, is a convex set. The second set is a polytope. But they don't refer to any particular scenario. But then we can identify the following result. For any graph, there's always a quantum means, let's say, such that the quantum set of probabilities is exactly something that in graph theory is called the Grotzel-Dobatz-Shriver theta body of the complement of the graph. This is exactly the set of physical correlations according to quantum theory. And the maximum of this set is what is called the Lobatz function of the complement of the graph. And this result identifies the Lobatz number as a fundamental physical limit for quantum correlations, and the theta body as the set of physical correlations for a given graph. The nice thing is that this strategy of focusing on graphs without referring to any specific experimental implementation substantially simplifies many problems, and in particular the problem of characterizing the quantum set. Why the quantum set? But also the problem of deciding whether a given point is or not quantum, which without this approach is by itself a super difficult problem. And this leads us to the exclusivity principle, which just said every set of n pairwise exclusive events, in the sense defined before, is n-wise exclusive. Therefore, from Kolmogorov axioms, the sum of the probabilities of n-wise exclusive events cannot be higher than 1. Therefore, Kolmogorov plus the exclusivity principle tells you that the sum of probabilities of n pairwise exclusive events cannot be higher than 1. But notice that the exclusivity principle doesn't follow from Kolmogorov axioms. Why this principle? Well, it is the only principle I know capable to single out convex sets of quantum correlations. Not just points, maximum, but actually whole sets of quantum correlations. No other proposed principle is able to do that. Just let me introduce some results. This is a result together with Marcelo Terracuña and Barbara Moral. Given a quantum set, assuming a quantum set for a given graph or the complement of a graph, you assume that, then the exclusivity principle singles out exactly the quantum set for the original graph. Moreover, if the graph is self-complementary graph, like the pentagon is, the exclusivity principle, without any further assumption, excludes any set of probability distributions strictly larger than the quantum set. And now let's move to another result by Julia, which is, Julia formulates this principles. Principle number 1, which is called fundamental sharpness of measurements. The assumption or the principle is that every measurement arises from a sharp measurement performed jointly on the system and on the environment. Every measurement. Principle number 2 is that the set of sharp measurement is closed under coarse graining. Well, these two imply a principle. Mixing this and shaping the previous result, you can prove this. At least for the probability assignments of self-complementary exclusivity graphs, fundamental sharpness implies Born's rule. I didn't make assumptions. I just focused on a particular kind of theory. It's very weird. Theories in which all measurements are sharp. Why? Well, no reason, but out of that, I recover, at least in some specific cases, Born's rule. After this, you can have different attitudes. You can keep saying, well, noise is fundamental. Or you can say, noise is not fundamental, and argue that only arises from the fact that the realistic measurements do not measure only the system, but also the environment. But you can be a little bit more radical in saying, make the following observation. Consider the set of general probabilistic theories and ask yourself, what are the chances that your GPT has this principle of fundamental sharpness? Okay, probably the answer is something like epsilon. But quantum theory is a GPT with fundamental sharpness. Therefore, to understand quantum theory seems not wise to view noise as fundamental. And like, try to be even more radical. What does all this mean? Well, the focus of the theory we have on interactions particular interactions out of which we can construct shared measurements, and the focus on just that maybe is the best possible trick to deal with parts of nature for which nature doesn't have laws in the useful sense. So it's not a coincidence that quantum theory has fundamental charters. Actually, it's a wise movement in a particular kind of universe. The focus on the theory. Imagine you assume that you construct, you are a universe maker, and one of the ingredients in the universe is that there are some slicings of the universe, some experiments you can make of it, for which you don't have any probability assignment a priori.
Okay. So by a law, you mean a property assignment to outcomes of...
Yeah. But in the same universe, you put cavemen that want to understand what is going on, want to identify the best trick, the best tool to make predictions, even in that circumstances. And what is suggested here is that a wise movement is precisely to isolate interactions such that out of them you can construct objects you can label as shard measurements.
So when you say interactions, you mean like dynamics?
I mean interactions in the sense of things that produce an outcome.
Okay.
That's it. Yeah. All kinds of things that produce an outcome. Also in this third contextuality war is the problem, one of the justification is the connection between contextuality and experiment. And I want to be fast here. Basically, after this, there are two attitudes of, okay, this is the third point, testing, how to test contextuality in experiments, and better, how to analyze something that you call a contextuality test. There are basically two options. One option is to assume that noise is not fundamental and keep the old notion of contextuality, and then use hypothesis testing to evaluate the probability that the data you are observing can be explained by a non-contextual model, assuming that the noise you have in your experiment can be traced. You know why. You know why you have a noise, because you don't have perfect alignment, for instance. Plenty of reasons. You can guess what if I would have. Or a version of this is use Winters or better Kujala et al. Method to quantify the contextuality of the data. Okay. Other possibility is to assume that noise is fundamental and then adopt Rob's notion of contextuality. See you next talk. And I will want to end this talk by providing a third way out, which is what you can do is to convert any contextuality test, any experiment that supposedly is revealing contextuality in the shard measurement definition of contextuality into a Bell inequality test. How you do that? Well, basically, this is the method. And you start with a compatibility graph for a given scenario. Now the vertices are observables, sharp observables, and the edges are compatibilities between them. Notice that when you have this might mean many things. This might mean the typical Bell scenario, which you have Alice here and Bob here, and they are compatible because they are separated. Or you can have a source here, Alice doing sharp measurements, Bob doing sharp measurements such that Bob measurements are compatible with Alice. Okay. Now remember the notion of event, the notion of when two events are exclusive. So out of your scenario, you can construct the exclusivity graph. Here I, for simplicity, I adopt a different notation. Now events in the same straight line or circumference are pairwise exclusive. This is an exclusivity graph. And you can transform, you can always transform your figure of merit into a positive linear combination of probabilities of events in this sense. For instance, for the closure horse you hold Bell operator, you can do the following, and you end up with this S. It's a sum of probabilities of events. Okay? And you can re-express your Bell or non-contextuality inequality in this way. And you can produce, these are the relevant events, you can produce the exclusivity graph for these relevant events, okay, which is a subgraph of the original graph of the scenario. But now is when we will use a first result, which is that quantum theory violates a given non-contextuality inequality if and only if the exclusivity graph you have at the end contains at least one induced pentagon, heptagon, nonagon, which are called in graph theory holes, or their complements. These are the holes, these are the anti-holes. So in particular, the reason why you can expect a quantum violation of the closure Horst-Schumann-Hold inequality is because you can define an induced pentagon, actually 8 of them, in the exclusivity graph. Okay? Actually, a funny exercise is you take your favorite Bell inequality or Kochan-Specker proof, and you count the number of primitive graphs, induced primitive graphs it has. Okay? So you can, this is a way of decompose any exclusivity graph into primitive graphs. And the next technical movement is noticing that any primitive or basic graph can be converted in which is called a definite prediction set. A definite prediction set is an object like this you have in an original Kochan-Specker set. It's something which, if you assign value 1 to this, the value of this has to be 0 with certainty in any non-contextual hidden variable model. But the observation here is that any basic graph can be converted univocally for a given dimension into an object like this. For instance, if you have a pentagon, you have this DPS, which actually is not new. It is exactly in John Bell's paper. If you have a nonagon, you have this thing, which again is not new. Okay? And then you can follow the strategy of the proof of the Kochan-Specker theorem. You connect the initial state with an orthogonal state through these elements. Then you complete this connection, connecting a complete basis. And you can do this in any dimension. And this is for a given primitive graph in your experiment. You repeat the process for any of the primitive graphs you have. Okay? And you end up with what? With a super big Kochan-Specker set. Okay? And we know how to convert a Kochan-Specker set into a Bell inequality. So you end up, you start with a particular point violating a particular inequality, and you end up with a Bell inequality violation. What's the deal? Well, the features of this method is that it's free of the conceptual problems of finite precision and unsharpness. Of course, you have the practical problems of finite precision and unsharpness. Okay? Every quantum point out of the non-contextual polytope, in the sense we define, can be tested this way. And there's a one-to-one correspondence with the original state you use in the original test, and the original measurements you had to use in the original test, and the measurements you do for this test. Moreover, there's a one-to-one correspondence with the basic structures that made the original state and measurements to violate the original non-contextuality inequality. Well, in any case, the method for producing a Cauchy speckle set out of any quantum violation of any non-contextuality inequality might be of interest by itself. So I started with John Wheeler saying, where does quantum theory come from? I try to make a point that using the old notion of Kotchev-Specker contextuality, you learned a lot. So I will try to summarize what I meant. I meant that the emphasis, which is not my emphasis, it's an emphasis within quantum theory on Schur measurement is important. Because the fact that we can derive fundamental aspect of quantum theory, this convex sets, out of the principle of fundamental sharpness, suggests that making a whole theory around focusing on Schur measurements might be the best trick to deal with universes in which, for which we don't have laws. And moreover, suggests that quantum theory is simply this trick. Thank you.
Thanks. Lots of time for questions.
Yes, thank you for this very clear talk. I kind of like how you were doing arguments for Schur measurements, and I can see that you can formalize it in GPT. But what I don't really see is so, like the connection to noise and Schur measurements. So un-Schur measurements, for me, it's not only about noise. Like for instance, how Julia axiomatized Schur measurements, there is not a thing like a quantification of noise. You need to have repeatability and that sort of things. So for me, un-Schur measurement doesn't mean that it would be necessarily more noisy than Schur measurement. So somehow, I kind of see that as a valid reasoning what you have, but I'm asking you, since Schur measurement can give you something interesting often that you cannot get with Schur measurements, don't you want to see what they could give you in this contextuality framework? It seems to me that you are throwing them away, just saying, they're noisy, so I don't care about them. Okay, you have some of them are noisy, you have some of them are very interesting and could give you something.
I'm not saying they are not interesting. I'm not saying you don't have to study them and find out what is interesting. What I'm saying is that there's value in focusing on Schur measurements. All these things, all this emergence of Born's rule, wouldn't appear if you insist in following the path of un-Schur measurements. It's all I'm saying.
To ask a question about implementing any Kutchen-Specker test as a Bell test. So is it plain that for any Kutchen-Specker test, you can separate the observables into two disjoint subsets, one of which can be realized, all of them, as observables in one subsystem and the other one as observables in another subsystem, or is it something different from that?
Oh, wait. First of all, the answer to your question is yes, but this is not a new result. We knew it how to do it long ago. This is, for instance, in this paper, take any Kutchen-Specker set, and you can make a bipartite Bell inequality in the standard sense exactly how you describe it. The method is different. The method is, what if you start not with a Kutchen-Specker set, but you start, let's say, with a violation of a particular state-dependent violation of a particular non-contextuality inequality. Let's say a violation of the clear screen equality on a single qubit doing sequential measurements. You can have objections on how to make sense of that test of contextuality. What the method tells you is how to convert this experiment into an experiment in which you have two qubits in a maximally entangled state, and what you do is exactly a biperfect standard Bell inequality in which all the measurements you perform are related to the original measurements you need in a sequential case, including one of the measurements you perform is related to the initial preparation you need to get the violation you wanted. So the
I'll have to see the detail.
I just want to make sure about what you mean by noise and non-shock. So that was it Myers who did the rational case? Yeah. So Conway and I wrote a paper called The Will Theorem, in which we had a section in which we worried about the following. If you know, the original result was about being orthogonal frame. In fact, these frames, how can you tell that the frames are only close to being orthogonal? Well, you're not going to get sharp results, but you're going to get probabilistic results in that case. I mean, that's the difference. And we worked it out and we found that, you know, if they're off by a second of arc or something like that, the chances that the probability of these results being the case are like 1 in 30 million. So you only get a probabilistic result. Is that covered by what you call noise and unsharp? Namely, what, not the results of the measurement, but that you can't assume that the original frame is really orthogonal. And I think it was Larson also did a similar. Around the same time. That if you don't assume that they're orthogonal, but they're very close to orthogonal, you can't get an absolute result anymore. It's a probabilistic one. But the probability becomes very, very high that that you can't get this.
Okay. For the question, this is for sure a source of noise. The fact that you cannot assure that you are measuring, but just with a given angle.
You call that noise.
This is a way of getting noise. I'm not saying the only one. The issue is that in a Bell inequality test, you don't need to care about it if it's because the assumptions made that if your implementation is good enough, a violation of the Bell inequality per se.
Yes, but Bell inequality is about probability already.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the other one is about truth and falsity.
Correct.
You can't stay with that if you assume.
Okay.
No.
This also tells you that you can transform any Cauchy Specker into a Bell inequality. This is one to one. But as I said, here this last movement is a little bit more than this. You can transform any violation of a non-contextuality inequality, which is also probabilistic and is state dependent, into a Bell inequality. And the funny thing is that in between you need first to construct the Cauchy Specker set.
Okay. Question here. Yes, I wanted to ask about this relation between non-locality and contextuality, because at the beginning, so you said that contextuality generalizes the notion of non-locality, but then, then you say every Cauchy Specker contextuality can be seen as a Bell test. So how?
Okay, why I do this? Why? Because I still keep in what I said at the beginning. Contextuality generalizes. Okay. But many people are not satisfied by how the contextuality tests are conducted. The only purpose of this last movement is to show that even if you are not satisfied with this notion of contextuality or with these experiments, there's always a way to transform into experiments you like. Okay? So just to, so that these problems that apparently are conceptual, fundamental problems, you can make them practical. Suggesting that they were conceptual in the first place. So this is the
problem. Yeah, I see this. In which sense contextuality generalizes?
Because why you have a violation of any of these Bellian parties is because you have a violation of the original inequalities. And for the original inequalities, you might be talking about the stated and independent violations in which you cannot attribute anything to Bob or Charlie. Or single particle, one Q-tree. Can you do a Bell inequality test with one Q-tree? No, but you can convert it into a two Q-tree experiment, respecting all the elements you need to claim contextuality for the one Q-tree.
Yeah, so I have a few questions / comments. So you can go back to the place where you introduced the Lovash number. What is the precise statement that you say there?
The precise statement I said is not exactly what is written.
My question comes first because I don't agree with the statement, and also because
which statement? The one who's written or the one I said?
I don't know which is the one that you said, but the one that is written there actually contradicts what you say in your paper. So basically, in your paper, the original CSW paper, you actually give an example of a contextuality scenario where, when you compute the Lovash number of that exclusivity graph, you don't get the maximum quantum violation.
Oh yeah.
You get another number that is far above the actual value of the quantum violation.
Yeah. Okay, let me explain.
So this theta number actually doesn't characterize quantum violations.
No. Okay, good question. The example in that paper was the Bell inequality called I3322, which is a bipartite Bell inequality with three second equals two outcomes. Is that, let's say, second simplest Bell inequality ever. First let me answer this. If I give you a graph, an exclusivity graph, and I ask you, okay, think in all possible ways to implement this exclusivity graph with quantum systems. Okay? And then I ask you, what is the set giving you the probabilities that you can assign to this thing? The answer is the theta body.
Okay, so
and the maximum is the lowest. But your question is different. If you ask me what happened with I3322, say, well, I3322 is one of the millions ways of implementing a particular graph. So on one hand, you have I3322 and you have the graph. You say, well, but in I3322, the maximum quantum is smaller than the Lovash number. I say, yes, but I have a way in which I can reach the Lovash number of this graph, which is not in a Bell scenario, which actually, in this particular case, is using a single five-dimensional system.
Okay, but then, so because later on you say that with this method you can actually characterize quantum correlations.
That
claim, and basically you say that following from this statement that the theta body is the thing that characterizes quantum correlations, but then that's actually not true because so the problem of characterizing quantum correlations, what it tells you is that I give you a scenario. And we want to know which are the correlations for that scenario. If there exists a scenario that has an equivalent graph and that could achieve such a thing. That's a different question.
It's a different question on purpose. For the first question, if I ask you, I give you a point and I ask you, is it quantum? Most likely the answer is undecidable.
Yeah, exactly. You cannot, if you have scenario and you have a
computer, for this problem, which is different, the problem is now, I give you a exclusivity graph and I ask you about the set of all possible quantum realizations and I ask you the same question, I give you a point, and is it quantum or not? This is super easy. For the first problem, if I ask you why you get the maximum of I3322, okay, we still even know yet the analytical maximum of I3322.
I know.
Okay. But if I don't care about this particular scenario, but about the structure of exclusivity, then I can explain a convex set. This is my point. This is exactly my point.
Okay, but I think that, I mean, you're using a name to define a problem that people usually use that name to define a different problem. So
No. When I said quantum correlations, I put quotations, quantum correlations, and here specifically, I said the strategy of focusing on graphs without referring to any specific experimental scenario substantially simplifies the problem of characterizing the set of, quantum correlations. For the graph. So by transforming the problem, I simplified the problem, I found principles that explain the quantum boundaries.
For a particular problem, not for the problem of quantum
boundaries
that people are using.
Yes, let me add a comment.
Okay.
This is actually motivated by, there are two programs of research in foundations. One of them is the program of reconstructions from operational principles. Lucien, Giulio, Marcus Müller, okay? Many others. This is a super hard problem to solve. And these guys solve it. A super hard problem, and they solve it. And there's a very simple problem, which is the problem of identifying principles of quantum correlations in the sense you are defining quantum correlations. Well, after 20 years, we don't have any single principle that explains a whole convex set. Any, by far. So the reflection is, why a super hard problem has been solved, why a super easy problem is not solved? And this is an attempt to merge these two things. Instead of focusing on particular scenarios, you focus on the structure. And then you connect to the two problems. Okay, the fundamental Charles principle of Julia is actually a principle in the old sense and give you an answer for a version, you're right, of the second problem.
So we're running out of time, but Bob is dying
to ask the first part. So granting that under whatever definition, the set of correlations that satisfy this is exclusively gives you the quantum set. So give it, like, that's what you were arguing for, like the previous question. So granting that, my question is, what's the landscape of DBDs satisfying the assumptions that you mentioned, like fundamental sharpness, which can reasonably explain your data? Is it just quantum theory? Is that the claim? Because that sounds to be the claim, right?
No, not yet. Hopefully,
because that's what you said, fundamental sharpness gives you the bondable or something.
In some particular cases.
Okay.
At least for explaining the set of quantum correlations associated to a particular type of exclusivity graph, namely self-complementary.
So let's say hypothetically you could do it for everything. Not just for specific cases, but it's...
Oh, that would be huge.
Okay, let's say that's... So if that was the case, then I'm just wondering, what are the competing explanations that you're trying to sort of... Is it only the non-contextual sense of Cauchy spectrum versus quantum thing, the distinction that you're trying to draw, or are you also trying to draw a distinction between quantum and post-quantum? Because it doesn't look like you're trying to draw that distinction, right? Because it seems like some of the claims that if you have fundamental sharpness, then you just get quantum theories. Like, at least the courage. Like, that seems to be the flavor of the claim.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if you already presume fundamental sharpness in your operational theories, then if you do an experiment, what are you ruling out versus? Like, I'm saying quantum versus post-quantum. Like, you're not drawing that distinction anywhere, right? Like, once you assume
from there. Okay, first of all, the first question, the landscape, is still we don't know the landscape.
Okay.
It might be the case we have more queer theories like this. Hopefully, fundamental sharpness plus more things single out quantum theory. Okay, and remember that my purpose at the beginning was precisely understanding quantum theory. And now it's not about, this is what I try to do with the radical position, it's not I'm assuming fundamental sharpness. I'm suggesting something else as which is the fourth, is I'm not assuming anything. Imagine a universe with no laws for certain partitions. And now think yourself about how to make sense, how to make science in this. If I could prove that what we call quantum theory is the best way, I would be happy in the sense that I would have an answer of to the question, why quantum theory?
But to do that, you postulate fundamental sharpness.
It's not a postulate. It's like, it might be the case that the universe doesn't have fundamental sharpness. It's me, the postulate here is that there are no laws at some level, and it's me sort of choosing tools to create me a fiction of what we call fundamental sharpness. It might be only approximate with respect to what the universe offered me,
mm-hmm.
but out of that, a quantum theory will emerge.
Okay, we're going to end again.